Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring this podcast. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System, you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. At hundreds of locations across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unifiedhealing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
My name is Jari Bolander. Welcome to the Entrepreneur Ethos Podcast. On this podcast, we're going to take a deep dive into the traits, values, beliefs, and skills of all sorts of entrepreneurs to learn how to build a more ethical, inclusive, and resilient world. Let's get started.
Today, I talk with Richard Reese, co-founder of Most Recommended Books, a website that tells you which books have shaped the world's most successful people. Before Richard learned to code at Lambda School and started Most Recommended Books, he worked in LA at a movie studio with his dad, which is his first experience at a startup. Those 5 years working with his dad making movies was a baptism by fire to the realities of what it's like to create something from nothing. He learned that distribution is something that is really tough to get right, even tougher than creating something from nothing. He learned that once you build it, you're really only half done. Then you have to sell it. This is why having a co-founder that complements you is so important. If one of you can build it, then the other should be able to sell it. That's a powerful combination that's rare to have in any one person. He learned to make sure you think about how to sell what you create rather than doing it later. He's also a big believer in doing lots of small projects to see what sticks. We talk about how he came up with the idea for Most Recommended Books, and how he has built it into a nice business. Most Recommended Books is a perfect example of scratching your own itch and testing an idea by just doing things and seeing what happens. Now, let's get better together. Richard Reese, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Derek.
So you have a pretty cool website that it's called Most Recommended Books. And it's actually a really fascinating idea that I can't wait to dig a little bit more into because, of course, I like to write books and read books. And who doesn't? If you're an entrepreneur, you absolutely need to read lots and lots of books. But before we do that, why don't you give us just a little bit of a background on how you came to do what you're doing right now?
Cool. Well, I come from Angola, which is south of Africa. I moved a lot growing up. Like I would move to different schools in different countries every 3 years. So I was always, doing things a little bit differently. And that is why I naturally drifted towards building stuff, you know. So the choice was between, work at a normal job or start building stuff. And I just always drifted naturally towards things like that. And kind of like with any idea, it wasn't a lot of planning. You just kind of stumble into these cool opportunities and you seize the chance. And that is how I stumbled into most recommended books.
Hmm. And so do you have a coding background or where'd you technical?
So I learned how to code about 2 or 3 years ago at this bootcamp named Lambda School.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I am what's it called? A project sponsor at Lambda School. We can talk about that a little bit later.
Oh, cool. That's awesome. Yeah. Lambda's awesome. That's where I learned how to code. I had always, done a little bit of coding here and there. When I was, like 14, I would hack my computer. I have a few YouTube videos, tutorials showing people how to hack your computer from when I was 14, 15. But really, the formal coding training came from Lambda School. And that was about 2 years ago.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, Lambda School is such an interesting model. One of my friends, Mark, actually started doing, I think he's been at it for 3 months now or something. I don't remember exactly when he started, but he actually slacked me. And he's like, hey, Lambda School is looking for projects that they could give to their students. Do you have an idea for a project? And I'm like, oh, do I have the project idea for you guys? which ended up being in their last labs batch, which I think is labs 22, now is continuing on to labs 24. And it's something that we're calling data-driven transit. And it's related to the SFMTA or the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency and making Muni better. So it's a really cool idea of how they have, UX, UI, back end, and data science come together in these little capstone projects, which I've been so far, it's been really cool to just kind of be, this is what I want. And then they kind of go build it, or at least, we kind of negotiate that. But it's a really cool program. I mean, they seem to be pretty on top of it. Is that your experience?
Awesome. Yeah, absolutely. And you also learn how to work in teams, so that was quite important for me. It was, how do you work with other developers? Not just which tools you use, but how do you communicate? How do you divide who gets to do what? So that was super, super valuable.
Neat. And what track did you end up doing?
When I did it, I was the seventh cohort. So back then they called it CS? So computer science track. Now it's known as the web development track.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. Cool. And so what did you do before you learned how to code? What was sort of your day job?
Before learning how to code, so I worked in Los Angeles for a few years. My father started a movie business. They're a small production company, and I didn't really grow up with him, so this was just a good opportunity to learn from someone who's one of the most interesting founders I've met, so getting to work directly side by side with him and learning from him was just a really great experience.
So you were, what kind of movies were you guys doing?
It was smaller. So straight to DVD movies. It was, we did one small theatrical release, which didn't do too well theatrically, but then it did well on streaming platforms like Netflix and iTunes. And that was, it was kind of like it really was a startup. So he really started from scratch, and I got to participate with him for I would say 5 years. Wow. So it was a bit of a baptism by fire. Yeah, it was a lot of work, but it was very, very cool.
Yeah, most movies, like I have some friends in LA and then they do like TV stuff. Like they were doing reality TV shows for Murray Brum. I think it's Murray Brum. I can never get their name right. But they would always tell me how they would like they would bring a team together, do the season, and then the team would go away. I mean, it's the ultimate like job shop kind of thing where you literally pull the entity together. You get all the money, you do the production, yeah. And then everyone goes off on their merry way.
And what we did was interesting because there was that. It's like there are times where you're employing hundreds of people and then it's like three people, you know. So that was definitely interesting. And what my dad really was trying to do was his own mini studio, which meant all the financing, all the production and all the distribution was handled in one place. The financing and production we did quite successfully. The distribution is where it gets really tricky. And this is where a company like Netflix is so interesting because they started with the distribution, right? So yeah. They built this platform where people can watch movies and then they went into production. So they started doing their own content. We did the other way, which was super hard and doesn't work as well, which is we would produce our movies and then we'd also try to distribute them ourselves. But what really happens in Hollywood, the right way to do things is you make a movie, let's say you shoot something and you go to the studios. So you go to 20th Century Fox or you go to Universal or you go to Sony and you say, you know, help me distribute this movie. And they have the connections with all the theaters and well, back when you bought DVDs, all the DVD stores, they have all those connections. So they handle that for you, much like an artist being signed by a label. Mm. You know, so like the label will give you all the distribution. So usually the studios do all the distributing. But we decided, you know what, like we'll talk to the theaters and we'll buy the posters and we'll do all, which is... It was a mess, but it was a lot of fun because we got to experiment and learn.
Yeah.
You know, so like... Yeah. So the next projects we make will be through a lot of trial and error, but each time we just got a little bit better.
You know? Yeah. Well, I mean, what's really fascinating about what you just described is that's the challenge every startup has, is how do you build your audience? How do you build your following? How do you get people to, you know, distribute your product, buy your product? Even if you're a direct-to-consumer, how do you get people to come to your website, buy it? How do you get the word of mouth? I mean, it's the same exact challenge. I mean, that's why places like Amazon is a distribution channel, right? That's why they're so powerful. Yeah. That's why Facebook for social is so powerful. I mean, they build a platform of all the people. So, wow. Exactly. I mean, that's pretty amazing. So is your dad...
Netflix.
Yeah. Same thing. Yeah. Is your dad still doing the production company?
Yeah. So there, it's a small involvement, you know, like we haven't made a movie in 5 years or more. And I really started doing my own thing just because like, I think I learned everything I had to from my dad, you know, it was like either go work with him or, you know, go to college in the UK and go get a job somewhere in the UK. And I decided to take the risky route and learn from him. And that was cool. And now I feel like I can do my own things, you know, but the movie business is still around. So if there's a project that's interesting, like we always take a look, it doesn't take a lot of time. Like you said, it's, if you have a good script and you have a good director or producer, all you have to do is basically make sure that everything is running well, you know, like the you hire these hundreds of people, which usually the director or producer does, and you just have to make sure everything is looking okay and on budget. And these are, depending on how long the movie takes to film, which in our case, these are lower budget movies, so it's a few months. It's very like short term work, you know?
Yeah, I always found it fascinating as a model for creative projects. I mean, you know, it's similar like with a book. I mean, books take longer than a couple of months, but what you end up doing is if you're a self-published author, you know, you spend all your toil and trouble writing the thing. You don't know if it's any good. Then you go hire an editor And then they say, oh, it's not that great. And then you try to get distribution. And for authors, it's awful. Distribution of books is just awful. Even with the new self-publishing platforms, you sit there trying to figure out, like, well, how do I get this audience? it's insane. Right. It's similar. Yeah. I mean, it's very similar to the movie business. And I always say, once the book's done, that's half the battle. Like, the other half is trying to market it. I mean, the reason
and this
why
goes with everything.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So it's even in startups, like, really, if you divide it to their most basic components, so you have to know how to build and you have to know how to sell. And with anything, with a book or with a movie, you know, you make the movie and you sell the movie. So there's always that production and distribution to whatever endeavor you choose.
Totally. I mean, that's actually a really good way to put it. Build it, then you got to sell it. And I don't think a lot of entrepreneurs, especially technical folk, when it comes to the selling part, that's the place we fall pretty quick. I mean,
right.
I've had to learn the hard way about sales.
Yeah, if you look at those who build, they always find someone who can sell. So if you look at like Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, so Steve Wozniak built and Jobs would sell it. You look at Larry Ellison and Bob Miner, so like Bob Miner would build, Larry would sell it. Occasionally you find that rare, you know, diamond who can both build and sell. So you look at someone like Mark Zuckerberg, or you look at someone like Bill Gates in a way. Obviously, there's a bit of interlap with co-founders, but
right.
Every now and then you find someone who's just good at both. And those are really rare, and watch out for them, you know. But most startups, you have to do both things well. You have to build and you have to sell.
Yeah, it's such a hard thing. I mean, over time, you know, I've tried to get better at sales, and it's one of those things. It feels just more challenging. I think part of it is just in terms of mentality and attitude and what you're good at and if you've kind of been in organizations and the kind of the sales market, and I include marketing in this too, sales and marketing, sort of this nebulous void that sort of, you know, things get sucked into and you hope that money comes out of it, you know? And, you know, it's kind of a harder job than creating, actually, because you have to try to figure out how to, you know, have someone part with their money, right? Hard-earned money. And, you know, to have the audacity to say, buy my stuff over someone else's stuff it takes some training, some chutzpah, some, you know, it's a different mentality. And you're right. It's so hard to do them both well. And I've found some founders, like some startup founders that I know that kind of have that knack for it, but you know, the build it then sell it is it's exactly right. Half the battle is building it. The other half is selling it. So
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And so right now you're doing this thing called Most Recommended Books, which I found pretty darn cool. Cause again, I read a lot. and I write books and I always want to figure out like what other people are reading. Can you tell us a little bit about that and kind of what that's about?
Yeah. So, with Most Recommended Books, it's two things. One, I was always saving these lists of books on my Evernote or now Notion, I guess. I was always saving these lists to myself, and I decided to just share them. I used to write, or I used to blog a lot more. I still blog occasionally, but I used to blog a lot, especially 2017, 2018. And one day I wrote this blog of all the books that Elon Musk recommended on Twitter. And that one post made more money than the other 50 plus posts that I wrote, I spent all of 2017 writing. So one post. Yeah. So I was like, okay, people are clearly interested in books. So maybe I should do, since I have all these notes, you know, so, and these notes came from reading all these biographies, you know, so you read someone's biography and the biographer says, and he read this book and it changed his life or her life.
Right.
So I would write it down, you know, and you wouldn't find these lists anywhere else on the internet. So I decided to put it all in one place. And it also came from Tim Ferriss's podcast. He, at the end of every podcast, he asks his guests what are their favorite books. So I decided to also put all of that in one place and combine it. And that's where most recommended books came from.
Wow. So did you code it up yourself?
Partly. So I have one of my best friends. When one of my blog posts did well, this blog post, How to Think Like a Programmer, it did really well. And so he and I talked about working together, and we tried all these little projects. So remember what I said about stumbling onto opportunity?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We kind of thought, you know, let's build these little projects until something just clicks, you know. And this is something we can talk about later, because I've noticed this as a pattern amongst many, if not all, successful people. They stumble onto these opportunities, so
they get lucky.
there's a lot of hard work and skill, but ultimately you never know. I don't know if you've read, there's this book called Facebook Effect about Mark Zuckerberg and how he built Facebook. And the most interesting part of the book to me was early on at Harvard, how many projects he built before Facebook.
Yeah.
So he built a ton of websites. And even before Harvard, even when he was younger, he would just keep building website after website after website after website until Facebook hit. And even after Facebook was a hit in Harvard and other colleges, he built another project. I think it was called Wirehog or something like that. So this guy was just building and building until something hit. And I noticed this pattern. So one thing my friend and I decided is, let's just keep building projects and not be romantic about any of them. Mm. You know, if any of them doesn't, you know, succeed after 3 months, we'll just, you know, take it behind the barn. And so with most recommended books, we noticed that every month it was making more money, and we weren't very focused on it. You know, we just left it there, and every month it was getting more views and making more money. And sometime in November, I thought, okay, we should go into this full time. So now I'm working on most recommended books full time.
Oh, wow. And how do you guys make money off of it?
The Amazon referral link. So every time someone buys a book, we get a percentage from Amazon.
Oh, okay. So it's sort of like affiliate referral link. So if you, I'll put a link to the site in the show notes too, because it's the cool thing is that you can kind of scroll through to the, I don't know, famous people, I guess would be the word I would use. then you can figure out what they recommend and click through. So, okay. So, so affiliate model, click through, and you source all these like recommendations through like the books. How do you get, you alluded to a little bit before about how you get all the recommendations, but can you kind of dig a little deeper into that?
Yeah, it started with, like I said, Tim Ferriss's podcast. So I went through every episode he did, and I got all the recommendations from the people there. And then for people like Oprah and Bill Gates, so it depends. Either I found them on a biography, or you can find them online. So like Bill Gates has on his website the list of books he reads every year.
Hmm.
So that was easy. Oprah had the Oprah Book Club. Ev Williams from Twitter.
Yep.
Has a Goodreads account.
Yeah.
So I could just go there.
I was going to say Goodreads is the one that I've, I mean, I have obviously a Goodreads account and it's hooked to Amazon. So it knows what I'm reading, and I'm not famous or anything, but I was wondering if that's another place to grab it.
Yeah. So not many of these people use Goodreads, but
yeah.
Ev Williams from Twitter is one of them, and Emma Watson, the actress who played Hermione, she also posts a lot on her Goodreads account. So I got quite a lot of books from those two people on Goodreads. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's every place is different. And every now and then, like, you see an interview on YouTube or you read in the interview online and, you know, like Peter Thiel will say this book, blah, blah, blah. And he quotes the book. So I'm like, oh, he read the book. So let me add it to the website.
And then are you doing any, I haven't dug super deep into it, but are you then like doing aggregate lists? So like, these are the top 10 books across all these famous folk, or are you working on something like that?
Yeah. So what I'm most interested in, more than knowing which books specific people have read, and this is because everyone's different, right? So like the things that will motivate you and push you to work your best are different from the things that will motivate me and push me. And so I thought, instead of me just focusing on like, you know, what are Bill Gates's favorite books and go read those, what are the books that all these, you know, call them successful people or world-class performers, what are the books that they all recommend the most? Hmm. And there's a page on my website called Top Books where you can see that list and you can see which are the books that all these 300 plus world-class performers across all sorts of different fields. So it doesn't matter which field you're in. What are the books that they all recommend the most in common? And that to me is a very interesting list.
Yeah.
Because it's you see some commonly known books, but then you see some books where you're like, wow, this is, I wouldn't have put this book in the top 10.
Yeah.
Or I wouldn't think it was in the top 10, but there it is.
What's one of those books that surprised you?
So this was a surprise and not really, well, it was a surprise, but not really. It was Ayn Rand. I don't know if you've heard of,
Her. I have, yeah.
So both her books, Atlas Shrugged and Fountainhead, are in the top 10. And it doesn't really surprise you because, you know, very motivated people tend to drift towards Ayn Rand. But at the same time, it surprises me because she's a bit of a controversial figure. You know,
I mean, she's the, I would say when it comes to conservative thought, I would say, let's see. Yeah, that's probably true. She's in the canon of conservative libertarianism thought. I mean, it's definitely, she's up there as one of their main scholars.
Right. And because of that, you don't expect, but at the same time, it's not much of a surprise. But the fact that both her books are in the top 10 says a lot, because these are some of the most successful people in the world. And to look at the list of top 10 books that they most recommend in common and see, oh, Ayn Rand is in the top.
Yeah, both of her books
are in the top 10.
Yeah.
You're like, okay, there's something interesting here. You know, so I found that pretty interesting, because most people, you know, they don't like to say that they read Ayn Rand, but there it is.
Yeah. Is it just nonfiction books or also fiction books?
Any type of book, so nonfiction and fiction. I think there is a fiction book on the top 10. Other than Ayn Rand. So there's
those two are fictional.
Yeah, they're fiction. Alchemist is in the top 10. Yeah, so it's both.
What's the one book that you just said, oh yeah, of course everyone's going to read that one in the top 10?
In the top 10. I think it was I was referring to Man's Search for Meaning. I'm looking at the list right now.
That's okay, cool.
Man's Search for Meaning being mm-hmm. one. Sapiens is another one. Mm-hmm. Like, Sapiens is one of these books where everybody has read it.
Yep.
So I wasn't surprised to see it in the top 10.
Yeah.
These are the books.
Awesome. Yeah, it is interesting to kind of cross over, like, what are the, you know, in the, I guess, I don't know. To me, it's like the canon of, I don't know, I don't want to call them like successful people, although they are, but the canon of knowledge for, you know, public figures or successful folk or have some notoriety. Because I mean, I think the list has got obviously the business people, then there's obviously politicians and actors who have a certain amount of notoriety, I guess. And
yes.
to kind of understand the canon for which they pull from. That's pretty interesting idea. I mean, I guess I should go try to read. I tried to read Atlas Shrugged before. I just couldn't get through it, but that's just me. I like to read other things, but interesting. So
there's something for everyone, right? So like I said, here's something I found very interesting from putting this list together. And it's how much we don't realize how brilliant Steve Jobs was. And the reason I say that is because as I look at the books recommended by most tech founders, you'll always find the usual suspects, right? So you're always going to find Hard Thing About Hard Things. You're always going to find 0 to 1. You're always going to find Andy Grove's books. Every person in tech will recommend these books, and most of their lists consist of these books. But with Steve Jobs, he was completely different from any of these other, like, I think he has one Andy Grove book in there and that's it, where most of his list is, I have 30 books that Steve Jobs, read, or at least has
admitted to reading.
He read it through sources.
Yeah.
And his list is all about mysticism, spirituality, you know, yogis. I believe his favorite book was Autobiography of a Yogi. That reads more like, you know, a yoga instructor than tech CEO.
Yep.
And when I look at that list, and when I look at how different he was from the norm, it just makes me think, like, you can look at the books that everyone recommends, and that is very interesting. But ultimately, it's all about finding what really works for you. You know, and if it's spirituality and mysticism and, you know, vegetarian diets, like, go for it. You know, it doesn't have to be the same as all these other people, even though I still find it interesting. But his list just showed me that you can go completely different, on a different path from the norm and still be fine.
Yeah, no, I mean, he you know, everyone talks about him because he was at a different, he was on a different level, I think, in terms of the way he thought about things and just general kind of attitude. I mean, as you mentioned before we started recording, you know, he was notoriously not a very nice guy, or at least he was pretty hard on his people. And, you know, if you just took that as the one aspect of him to emulate, which is a bad thing to emulate, you never want to, you know, be cruel or mean to people. This doesn't work in the long run. You know, it's like there's the whole person that you have to consider. And part of it's what they read, part of it's what influences them and how they go about the world and their philosophy. And that's the thing that I find the most fascinating about what you're trying to do, the books. And, you know, the people that I, you know, like to follow and kind of look up to in terms of, you know, mentors that I've never met, but mentors I can learn from, is how these books shape their philosophy. Because what I've also found through my, you know, doing this podcast and the books I write and, you know, the future books I'm going to write is that, you know, the canon of knowledge in the world, you know, most people have said it before, right? I mean, there's patterns, you know, there's story, it has structure, and the structure of story is, you know, been there throughout time. It's baked in our DNA. We just know a good story when we hear it. We know what moves us. We have that because throughout time, we have had to use story in order to survive. So all of us that are here today have survived because our ancestors told the better story than the ancestors to, you know, in the next village over or the next tribe, because we had to. Right. I mean, that's how we survive. So it resonates with us, just like it resonates. Negativity resonates with us as opposed to positivity, because the negative things are what we had to remember to not get eaten by the saber-toothed tiger. It's just fundamentally in our core DNA and our structure.
So but I'm guessing you've read either Sapiens or Joseph Campbell's work.
Oh yeah, yeah, the hero's journey. Yeah. Like, yeah, yeah. The,
okay.
The, yeah. Oh yeah, I'm really into story. I'm a certified StoryGrid editor, which is a methodology that we use, or that I use to all my books and how I analyze story. And the guy that came up with it, Sean Coyne, he's the one that wrote the whole story good. He works with Stephen Pressfield on all his books. And of course, anyone that's anyone in creativity needs to read Stephen Pressfield's stuff, because it's awesome. It's an incredible. Resistance. Yeah. Incredible. Yeah. You know, the war of art, and just all his stuff's awesome. But what Sean did in his book called The Story Grid is that he made a quantitative approach to how to write better stories based on the monomyth and Joseph Campbell, based on, Robert McKee and all his work. I mean, cause these all have themes, right? You can analyze a story and you know it works because it's got these themes, right? Or it's got these specific conventions, or the genre obligatory scenes as an example. So I really find this really cool, because I'm always looking to try to figure out how to write better stories, not only for my books, but obviously, you know, if you want to persuade and influence people to buy stuff, the company or organization that tells the best story will win in the long run. It just will. And
I agree. And by the way, like what you're saying really resonates with me, because part of building most recommended books is, so you talk about Joseph Campbell, and he talks about archetypes, right? So you construct these archetypes, and you can use this archetypal hero's journey, and you can put it on different characters. So the same hero's journey fits Harry Potter, and it fits Lord of the Rings, and it fits Star Wars. You construct this archetypal story, and through the patterns among these archetypes, you can apply them to different stories. So with most recommended books, really, part of what I like about this is that I can construct, like you mentioned before, I have lists of people who are successful in tech, people who are successful in politics, people who are successful writers. So you can construct your archetypal writer. So you look at the books that all the writers on my website have recommended, or you look at the books that all the entrepreneurs on my website have recommended, and you look at which books they've recommended in common. So you construct the archetypal founder or the archetypal writer, and you're always going to find patterns. So like with writers, I noticed that a lot of them recommend Anne Lamott's Bird by Bird. That's a very popular, or Stephen Pressfield. Stephen Pressfield's War of Art is another very recommended amongst writers, you know? So, that's something I like about the website, is you can construct these archetypal, investor. The archetypal investor will recommend very similar books. So, and then you can start there and then find your own voice amongst that.
Yeah. I mean, that's actually a really good point, because there's the canon of knowledge that if you're going to be a writer or an investor or an actor or a entrepreneur or an engineer, right? I mean, the quicker you learn the canon, the more kind of baseline, the standard in which to like launch off. Because what's interesting is that when you look at like how people become successful, as an example, there was a study that someone did about the Pareto principle. They basically ran a simulation to prove that the Pareto principle holds true for luck or for success and accumulation of wealth and all these sort of things. And the Pareto principle was this, it's the 80-20 rule, which a lot of people know. And the thing that's fascinating about that, and why, as an example, there's such a disparity in wealth inequality, which this actual simulation proved, that generally what happens is that wealth accumulates with smaller amounts of people. It basically 20% of the people own 80% of the wealth in general, because it has something to do with luck and opportunity. So if you have the skill. So if you've got the skills and then you're given opportunities and then you have a little bit of luck, and it's the luck that's what kind of determines it, then over time
you stumble.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Exactly your point about the stumble, right? But the thing that people don't understand, and it's a hard thing to kind of quantify, or at least it's a hard thing to swallow, is that some people are unlucky, and there's nothing you can do about that, except you can try to give them more opportunity, but you can also give them the skills to take advantage of the opportunity. And that's the most important, like, policy thing that people can do is skills and then opportunity after opportunity after opportunity, because you will never have equal outcome ever. Yeah. It just never goes there. Yeah, right. Yeah. And I'm sure if you look through all these books and you know how that kind of canon of knowledge, you'll sort of see what would be really interesting is that if you start doing like autobiographies of famous people and kind of dissecting them that way, where like what are some of the, you know, how often do they say certain things, you know? So as an example, you could kind of empirically prove that, oh yeah, they had a lot of skill, but also, boy, they got lucky because they were at the right place at the right time. Or, you know,
this is part of why when I say stumble onto the opportunity, like it kind of sounds like I'm kidding, but not really. If you can take the same skillful person or intelligent person, you can take the same person with the same level of intelligence, the same level of skill, and their one project succeeds and the other doesn't. Yeah. So a good example here is Jeff Bezos, where his first startup, forgot what it was, failed. His second startup, I hear, did pretty well. So, and Steve Jobs was the same way. So Apple did well, and Next did not do well. So the luck factor is a big factor.
Yeah.
You know, and this is part of my joke about stumbling onto opportunity and not being too romantic about your work. You keep trying different things until something hits. And you know, like, again, like, every rule has exceptions. So every now and then you'll have someone like Elon Musk, who, you know, he launches Tesla and SpaceX, and by hook or crook, he's going to make it work. You know, he could lose his entire net worth, but no matter what, he's going to work hard to make it work. So I'm not saying like just launch something and give up on it if it doesn't work, but most of the people I've studied, so whether Steve Jobs, Mark Zuckerberg, Bill Gates, like it was a lot of stumbling on. They're very good at seizing these opportunities.
Yeah, exactly. You know? So taking advantage of the luck was
of the luck factor, like you said. Yeah,
yeah.
Which you can have the same skill, you can have the same intelligence, you can have a lot being the similar, the same team, but you also have to be able to ride the luck factor. So that's very important.
Is the luck factor on anyone's list?
Oh, is that a book?
It is a book.
Oh,
it is a book.
I didn't know. Maybe it is. I'd have to look it up. Let's
see. It's I mean, we can put a link to the show in the show notes if it's there. But I actually read that book about 5 or 6 years ago. No, it was longer. It was like 10 years ago. And one of the premise being that the more, you know, time at bat, the more risk you take, the more things you do, the luckier you get. And this holds true. I mean, everyone in their kind of gut knows that the more times you do something, chances are you're going to be successful at it. And a lot of it, what's really interesting, is how people build up the thing. So there, you know, Scott Adams, I'm sure you've heard of him.
So you just said Scott Adams, by the way, and I looked at who recommended the luck factor, and he did. He's the one person on the website.
Oh, cool.
Who recommended?
Well, yeah, well,
Richard Wiseman.
Yeah, and I'll put a link to it, because the reason why it's so important to realize this, and because one of the things that I've done just recently, not recently, maybe with like 5 or 6 years, is that I work with professional athletes and I help them with their foundations. And one of the things that they always want to do is help kids, like help kids just like them. Most athletes came from nothing. They came from poverty. They, you know, they've had all the literally everything against them, except they worked really hard at a sport which they had a talent for, and a lot of them got lucky. And you can see, because you see all the friends they played with in college, you know, it's interesting that the statistics on, if you played college football as an example, like Division 1A college football, the chance that you're going to get in the NFL is the exact same chance that you're going to hit a unicorn. It's about 1.2%. So those odds are really low, right? So you're like, well, you know, literally the people that got there, not only were they good, because again, you get to college 1A ball, you're good, but they also, of course, they worked hard and they did all they had to do. But a lot of it is also luck, because there's only a certain amount of people in the NFL, and, you know, it could be the way the draft goes. And if you look at like the combine scores and all that, they've done statistics. It doesn't really matter. Like, there's no really direct correlation to like your combine score and how well you do in the NFL, because then you get to the NFL and the average NFL player lasts a year, if that, a year and a half, because they get hurt or whatever. So it's really like a luck of the draw. I'm not going to discount that they work really, really hard, but
this is something I wanted to say, because I don't want people to think I think it's all luck. So I saw a great quote recently by this actor, Shah Rukh Khan. He's like the Tom Cruise of India. He's
oh, cool.
Super famous. So he has like 3 billion fans, you know, that's wow. the meme. And something he tweeted, something that I found so interesting lately, where someone was talking about extreme stardom. So like what you see with him or with someone like Bieber. And he responded something like, extreme stardom is an accident that happens to very hardworking people.
Yeah.
So, you know, like the accident part is what we're talking about, the luck, but you cannot ignore the very hardworking part. You know, like you won't get as lucky as a very successful NFL player or a very successful entrepreneur or founder if you don't also have the other factor, so hard work being one of them. If you're not working extremely hard, the luck that we're talking about won't appear. So it's not like luck is the only factor that matters.
Yeah, you know, agreed.
There are many other factors, of course. Agreed. But luck is a factor.
I'm glad you brought that up, and I'm actually glad you clarified that, because I'm not saying that these guys don't work hard. They work extremely hard. Mm-hmm. The opportunities they have gotten is because they've worked really hard. And the thing that I think that we try to instill in these kids, right? So a lot of these kids that we work with, they want, like, I want to go to the NFL as an example, right? Like, I want to go to the NFL. And generally statistics are low, right? That you're going to do that. So as a kid, all the way to the NFL is, you know, it's 0.1. Yeah. It's less than 0.1%. I mean, it's just ridiculously low. So that means that option, albeit you could work hard for it and you could try to do it, you should have a backup plan. Mm-hmm. And the thing that we've found is that we have to expose them to the opportunities and that there's other things they can do, because a lot of times they don't know that they could be an engineer, they could work in sports as a sportscaster or in the back office. I mean, they're not exposed. They could be an entrepreneur. Now a lot of athletes are entrepreneurs. They do tech investment. They do all sorts of great things because they realize, like, my career in the NFL is going to, or NBA or whatever, is going to be not the whole entirety of my life. And if I get hurt, then what do I do? Right. So I see that as a really kind of powerful thing to instill in a lot of other people. Cause again, you may not have the natural talent. You got to go do something else, but getting back to Scott Adams and some of the things that he talks about, when he talks about luck and taking care of opportunity or being available, having an opportunity for it. He calls it a skill stack. So he always wants to improve his skill stack. So what he may be doing, or even, I mean, I'm the same way. Like, why am I doing a podcast in the middle of a pandemic? I literally started this podcast the day shelter in place order carried out in San Francisco. Like, the timing is either great or I'm a knucklehead, right? But why am I doing it? I want to talk to other people like you. I want to get to know you now that we know each other, that we may be able to help each other, or we may not, but we now we know of each other. But more importantly, it's a skill, and I'm building up this skill stack that now, hey, I can talk into a microphone. I can produce a podcast if I ever, you know, had the opportunity to go do something else. Like the first podcast I ever did was something called the Story Grid Editor Roundtable Podcast. And I did it for 5 seasons with a bunch of great people that they still do it. I actually left to go do this podcast because, you know, they had different like ideas. I had different ideas and we're like, okay, well, I'll just go do my own thing. Cause I was looking at it more towards business and they were looking at it more towards the art and craft of writing, which is where it started off. But that all happened because we were all study buddies. We were a study group. And then we started recording them. And then Sean Coyne and Tim Grawl, who do StoryGrid, we sent them a recording. We're like, hey, we're thinking about doing a podcast. They're like, yeah, go for it. This sounds great. We're like, it's not really that, you know, we're a little scared about it. But I learned a ton from them about how to do show notes, how to produce a podcast, invaluable. But it was literally like right place, right time, right skills. We were learning, you know, it was just StoryGrid was just starting. Now it's a lot bigger than it was, which is just awesome. And they just like are now taking it to such another level of just quality. It's just awesome, right?
That's very cool.
But it's the skill stack, right? You don't know what you don't know. And like, it may not work out, but I learned it, you know, I learned a ton about something and now I can go do something else. You know what I mean? I like the fact that
I totally get it. Yeah. The skill stack thing is something that I also read quite a bit about Scott's work, his book. I think it was recommended on Tim Ferriss's show. So like how to fail everything and still win big. So the skill stack was the concept that I most like from that book. And it is what you can plot the success of most recommended books directly to that concept. Because I also heard Sam Harris talking about this where he said, I'm not the best writer. I'm not the best neuroscientist. I'm not the best, I don't know, something else, meditator, but you combine these three skills and you get something special. And you look at Steve Jobs, like he wasn't the best programmer. He wasn't the best designer. He was a great salesman, maybe not the best, but you combine these skills and you get something very special. And so that's why I started stacking these skills. I blogged for a year. Every week I would post something differently. I learned finance obsessively. I spent all of 2016 just reading about finance. I spent all of 2017 just blogging. 2018 was all about learning how to program and Lambda. And now you get, you know, you put these skills together, like my writing skills and my programming skills and somewhat of design, even though that's really lacking. But I'm not the best programmer and I'm not the best writer. I'm not the best designer. I'm not the best salesperson, but you combine these skills and you get something pretty cool, which is most recommended books. And, you know, like obviously on most recommended books, I work with all the people. So one of my best friends, Anurag, he's a far better programmer than me. But if I didn't have at least some programming skills, you know, I would be I would be super useless. With this website, at least with this website, like he and I built it together, you know, and we were both our skills were ran precious to this website. So having a stack of skills is always valuable, you know, and that's something that I very much believe in as well.
Great. Well, Richard, it's been a wonderful conversation. I got a ton out of it, and it's super cool that you used to do movies with your dad and still sort of do. And you know, good luck with most recommended books, and thanks for the conversation.
Yeah, this flew by. Thank you so much, Tori.
Thanks for listening to the Entrepreneur Ethos podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did creating it. My hope is that you learned something that can make you a little bit better. If you enjoyed the podcast, please do share it with friends and review it on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also join my email list by visiting thedailymba.com to get my thoughts on what I'm doing to get better, as well as what I'm working on. You can also pick up my book, The Entrepreneur Ethos, if you want to learn the traits, values, and beliefs that I think we need to build a more ethical, inclusive, and resilient entrepreneur, and frankly, world community. Feel free to follow me on Twitter at TheDailyMBA and let me know if you have any questions or recommendations for a guest that you'd like me to talk to. Also, drop me a note if you try anything we talked about in this or any other episode. I'd love to hear what's working for you. Until next time, keep getting better.
Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, and Thomas Hearns. Legends, whose four-way rivalry defined one of the greatest eras in boxing history. Relive their decade of dominance in a new Showtime sports documentary, The Kings, a four-part series, now streaming on Showtime.